Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Three segments today. We'll hear from the political economist Sam Gindin on competition and the working class, and from community leader Leslie London on a fight against Amazon in South Africa, and from the journalist Tana Ganeva on the horrors of solitary confinement. Sam Gindin has been on the show many times, alone and jointly with his longtime friend and collaborator, the late Leo Panitch. Sam spent a quarter century as the research director of the Canadian Auto Workers Union. Since then, he's taught and written. He is the co-author, along with Leo, of The Making of Global Capitalism, published by Verso, and co-author as well of The Socialist Challenge Today, published by Haymarket. He's got a review in Jacobin of Persistent Inequalities, Wage Disparities Under Capitalist Competition, by Howard Botwinick, a 2018 reissue of a book originally published in 1993. The review has a lot about Botwinick's book, but is also full of Sam's observations on labor under capitalism and the unwisdom of encouraging more competition. Sam Gindin. So way back in the old days, we used to talk about a dual labor market, a monopoly labor market that had pretty high wages and a competitive labor market that didn't. First of all, was that ever true? And even if it was, is it at all true now?
Even when it was true, it had an awful lot to do with labor itself. Being strong enough to force results that weren't just based on competition, to force the companies to give them decent wages. But it was always fragile because the nature of capitalism, people used to think in those days particularly, but still do, that the nature of capitalism is that it goes from competition, a lot of small people competing with each other, to monopolization. And part of the monopolization thesis was exactly what you raised, that some workers could therefore be bought off by the monopolies. While others couldn't.
Those are the days of the labor aristocracy critique.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. Yeah, the labor aristocracy was the people who worked in, for the so-called monopoly. So what was always true about the development of capitalism is that it moved towards concentration and centralization and bigger companies. But the reality of competition is that it's part of the making of capitalism. The making of capitalism led to more competition over time, not less. As these companies were concentrated and became larger, they had the resources to compete. They had the research to compete. They had the ability to cross sectors. Aluminum companies would compete with steel companies for auto parts. Competition has always been about mobility. So the more mobile these companies became, the more competition there was. And the more finance developed, finance became, a vehicle for intensifying competition. And, you see it going global. In terms of competition. And so we're in a period of more competition. And that's crucial because we end up by making mistakes, both in terms of the aristocracy of labor issue, that over time, as long as part of the labor movement was weak, you couldn't maintain a privileged position in other parts, but also because the companies themselves had pressure on them that was competitive to undermine those wages. And then you see it in other ways. You see Corbyn and Sanders both emphasizing that the way to democratize the economy is to put workers on boards of directors. Now, aside from the fact that just being sitting there all of a sudden on a board of directors wouldn't change power relationships and how decisions were made in corporations, the fact of competition meant that if the context wasn't changed, there was this pressure on you to actually be integrated into those companies and worry about more about competition, which workers already always face this question of being dependent on the corporation. So this question of...
There's an aspect of psychology here. If you put a worker on the board or a worker's representative on the board, they will probably tend to identify more with the powerful, the boss, rather than their position as representing the worker. It seems almost designed to create that kind of identification, which would not work out well for the working class.
Yeah. You're taking workers who have learned from their daily experience that the boss not only has more power, but a sense that the boss actually represents technology and he knows what the market is and he knows who the suppliers are and he has the connections. Yeah, so there's a psychological sense. The boss is coming to it with, a sense of running things, and the worker is coming being intimidated, but also facing the fact that, well, doesn't the corporation have to do well so I can do well? So both the structural and the psychological impact of that. And that becomes very dangerous, because once you're identifying with a boss as this is your company, of course you're fragmenting the working class and you're competing with other workers, which is so crucial. The other thing that Botwinick says in his book, which is so important, and I don't think I appreciated it. I always thought of this more in terms of workers identifying with their boss, workers dependent on their own firm, being forced to compete to keep their jobs. But what Botwinick emphasizes is that when corporations are competing with each other, each of them finds particular ways of competing that lead to a lot of variation in terms of capital intensity, whether you're going to do this by having high-skilled workers or low-skilled workers, low-paid workers. The fact of competition and every corporation finding different ways to compete leads to really two things. And one of them is all these differences within the working class, part-time workers, full-time workers, low-wage, skilled, non-skilled. And that immediately creates this enormous difference. And so there's nothing spontaneous about thinking in class terms. In the union, you're thinking about how you protect yourself. There's a particularity about unions. They're not class organizations. They're defending their members, the random members that happen to be in that workplace. And then in addition to that, you have this difference in terms of wage structures and all the differences in health and safety and working conditions and, you know, whether they're actually going to stay there or not. And the other thing that happens is there's also this question of the reserve army. And in Marx, what used to be thought of as the reserve army of the unemployed, but it isn't. And that has to do with the point you're making about the changes in the labor market. The reserve army is really the threat that if you lose your job, and if it's a decent paying job, the alternative is so bad. Even if you get another job, you don't have to be unemployed. But if you're going to get another job that's going to be in terms of working conditions and health and safety and wages, that disciplines the whole class. So the point about the reserve army is that it begins to discipline the whole class. And the reason it can discipline the whole class is because in any workplace with decent wages, they're also always restructuring because of competition, introducing new technology. So there are always layoffs, even if there's new jobs someplace else. And that also raises the question of, yeah, whether you're going to be downwardly mobile. And that threat is disciplining the class as a whole, and the differentiation within the class is making it so hard to create a class out of this. And the working class organizations that they do have, like unions, don't overcome that because they're not class organizations. So thinking through competition raises all kinds of strategic questions.
Back in the late 90s, Alan Greenspan used to talk frequently about the fact that even though the unemployment rate was 4% or even a little lower at a couple of months, the working class was acting like it was much higher. There was a lot of anxiety about job loss, despite an apparently tight labor market. Here we are a couple of decades later, and we're still in this situation where the working class is in this constant state of anxiety. Well, pre-pandemic, the unemployment rate was sustained below 4%. And
I think what happened was, I haven't seen people talk about this very much, but I think what happened, you know, and what neoliberalism was so much about, was this forced restructuring of capital. You know, the acceleration of globalization, liberalization of finance, letting interest rates go high, not just to weaken labor through high unemployment at that moment to break them, but on a continuous basis, having pressure on corporations to compete. And the point is that when corporations compete, some businesses will go under, but that's always pressuring corporations to compete more. And capital as a class comes out stronger. Whereas for workers, when they're forced to compete, it destroys the only strength they have, which is potential solidarity. So there's a different class impact. But a key point here is, I think, is that what we started getting in the 80s and into the 90s was a constant restructuring. The notion that capital needed these occasional downturns to discipline the system wasn't quite true. You know, it's still true. Capital still has those recessions, whether they need them or not. Sometimes they just happen anyways. They don't have that kind of control. But the downturns actually didn't happen for long periods of time. You know, you didn't have anything through the 90s until 2001. Even in the 80s, it wasn't until the end of the 80s that you had the recession. So there was this longer period without a recession. And yet within that period, there was massive restructuring going on. Restructuring didn't wait just until there was a downturn. Restructuring was accelerated, and it had this impact on the working class of making them permanently insecure.
It's like the capitalists had adopted Trotsky's permanent revolution strategy.
Yes, yes. It was permanently insecure. And you could say for capital, in a sense, there was a permanent pressure of competition, either to hang on to what you have if you wanted to maintain your relatively privileged position, or to make breakthroughs. And what you really do see, if you look at the corporations that were the top 10 or 20 corporations in the 70s, and you look at that list, once you get to the new millennium, it's different companies. Even companies that kind of remain large, like General Motors, they actually go through a period where they actually were worried about disappearing. Companies like GE aren't there anymore. And when you look at the top companies, what you find is, you know, the predictable ones, Amazon, Walmart, the platform companies, and the health companies, which is also an interesting phenomenon in the States, that not having health care at one level makes each company less competitive because of the costs of health care aren't socialized. And yet healthcare has become this enormous space for accumulation for the United States. I think something like the top 10 health companies in the world in terms of equipment and supplying and privatization of hospitals and stuff, insurance, et cetera, are American.
On the left, there's lately been a return of a critique of monopoly, that monopoly is the problem. You have people like Matt Stoller pushing anti-monopoly position. We need, there's been a growth in urge to prosecute antitrust in ways that we haven't seen in a few decades. What do you think of this? Is monopoly a problem? How monopolized is this economy? And is antitrust and breaking up big companies a solution to anything?
Yeah, I would just add to what you just said is that with that also comes the idea of breaking up the banks. So a few things about it. Like, yes, you know, from a democratic perspective, the fact of these mammoth corporations, which have such a powerful hold on what happens in our lives in terms of what they do with investments and how it affects communities. So at that level, yes, monopoly is a problem, but, you know, to challenge that, you're actually challenging capitalism. In terms of monopoly, the way it's traditionally thought, and I think the way these people are thinking about it, they're thinking in terms of, you know, the ability to set prices, for example. Well, that's not what competition is about right now. It isn't as if inflation has been the problem because of corporations raising prices. The point is they do compete, and they compete dynamically, and if anything, it's an excess of competition. One of the things I think we have to think about, maybe we can come back to that towards the end, is a left program has to think about how it limits competition. Because as long as you have intense competition, or make it more intense, you're insisting that democratic questions can't be answered. Whoever you elect has to worry about how you make the economy and corporations in it more competitive. That has to be the goal of society. And, you know, if you look at a company like Amazon, which everybody thinks in terms of this incredible monopoly. Well, it's competing against retail companies quite successfully. It's competing with FedEx and UPS and delivery trucks. It's competing for the iCloud with all the other platform companies. It's crossing sectors and now competing through its whole food operations in retail food even. It's competing internationally. Because even though it dominates the United States, there's a whole fight over who's going to dominate in Asia and China. And it's competing to maintain its position, which it doesn't want to lose. So there's intense competition, and that competition includes driving things down for workers. There's no aristocracy of labor at Amazon in terms of the warehouse workers and the workers delivering packages. You know, if anything, what workers face is more competition. And in terms of the notion of monopoly as stagnation, you know, kind of the Baran-Sweezy arguments at the end of the 50s into the 60s, that's not true either. I mean, what we're seeing is an incredible dynamic. I'm using that in a clinical way, not that I'm proving of it, but a real dynamic thrust in American capitalism in terms of changing things, in terms of changing industry, our lives, you know, what goods we have, technologies. It's incredible, you know, the amount that's invested in research and software. Globalization means new technologies in terms of distribution, how to carry more distribution loads in new kinds of ships. I mean, everything is changing and being transformed. It's a world of competition. And the problem with antitrust stuff is, you know, as soon as you break up companies, first of all, you're going to have enormous instability for the workers. The argument that this will immediately help workers, I mean, whether it's good or not is, it's one thing whether you want to break up some power. But the reality is that the power in the capitalist class remains. For workers, they're going to have incredible instability, as we saw when the airlines were deregulated or, you know, or the communication companies were broken up. They just start competing more. They're going to have more competitors, and it's going to impact on their workers who are going to be restructured. In the financial sector, the idea of breaking up the banks doesn't solve the problem. What's the point of having more smaller banks who are competing with each other to become bigger banks and recreate that kind of concentration, and possibly having more instability if we have another crisis because these banks are smaller? This just isn't what the left should be focusing on. It's getting trapped into this notion of having more firms is more competition, and competition was never about the number of firms you had in an industry.
We're listening to the political economist Sam Gindin.
What I'd really argue that the left has to think about and isn't thinking about is how do you create spaces within capitalism? We're not about to end capitalism. How do you create spaces within capitalism that limit competition, and therefore by limiting competition have the space to change values and what is important in life? And through that, because it'll still have limits under capitalism, get people to think about what kind of society they want. And I think there's some real openings that we could use in this. One is the environment. The environment is a perfect space to say, leaving the environment to fragmented corporations competing with each other over profit, private corporations, isn't much of a strategy. We need to plan, and you can't plan unless you control what you're planning. And you have to plan in a way that's about social use, not hope that profitability will overlap and give you social use. So the environment is an incredible opportunity, and the environment isn't a marginal issue. I don't just mean socially, I mean economically. To deal with the environment means transforming everything about how we live, work, and travel. That's a big chunk of the economy. So making the environment as a place to fight over this question of competition leads to all kinds of other questions about public ownership and taking on class questions and power and questions of power. The public sector is another place. The public sector is supposed to not be determined by profitability and individual interests. And we have to take that more seriously. We have to say we do want it to be public. We want to expand it. We want not just universal health care and pharmacare, but we want to expand social services. But to say that, we also have to start talking, recognizing that a lot of time this just leads to bureaucracy. We have to talk about democratizing the public sector, and that means taking on unions who just think in terms of their own conditions as well. We have to think about how do unions actually relate to the people that they're servicing, and together have an alliance that democratizes it, because it's the only way they're ever going to defend the public sector anyways.
In New York State, we have some of the public sector unions opposing an effort to bring single-payer health care to the state because, you know, they lose their advantage that way.
I saw that. And, well, let me get to that in a second. I just want to give the third part of it. The third part of it is if you do the environment, if you really are expanding the public sector, and if you take on finance, and again, we're not strong enough to take over finance. I'm not sure we have the capacities to just take over finance and know what to do with it. But aside from that difficult question, we should be talking about some public banks, you know, to deal with the environment, to deal with infrastructure, and actually to learn about finance, because the left doesn't know much about it. You're one of the exceptions, and you really are an exception. But if we have public banks, we cannot say this is a public bank and now it has to go out and compete. Again, it leads to the same end point. We have to say that we're going to put a levy on every financial institution. They owe it to us after everything we've given to them through all of this. And that levy will create a fund which will go to these public banks. And that way, the only question is, how do you democratically use those funds? How do you allocate those funds democratically for the environment, for infrastructure, for creating new jobs and communities when they're being restructured? So in all these ways, I think there's a chance to actually start engaging workers more. If you're linking the question of the restructuring in their communities because they're losing a particular factory or a particular service is being privatized so that workers can start fighting for that, but fighting in the name of, we want different values. It's a public service, or we want it to be used for the environment because we need that. Then workers are engaged, and talking about things like just transitions isn't a slogan. And I think that through that engagement, and this has been my experience with workers, but once they're engaged in fighting and they begin to see expanding social services or addressing the environment as a solution rather than the problem, they suddenly actually begin to learn about the environment. They actually begin to read about it when they see it in the paper, and soon they figure it out. so there's all that potential. But I do want to get back to what you said about New York and the unions, because this is fundamental. The left depends on unions as the agency. They're the foundation for the politics that we want. And we have to stop just defending unions. We're not doing them a favor by constantly defending them. We have to be ready to challenge them, because this demands a transformation of unions. If unions are going to remain relevant, it's not a question of unions doing wonderful and we're challenging them. Unions are, you know, in spite of sporadic victories and courageous acts in some places, we're not going anywhere. And we have to ask why. How come we haven't been able to respond to all of this stuff? And it's because we have to transform unions. They have to begin to see that thinking in class terms isn't just some ideological thing. It's actually a pragmatic, practical way of winning. How do you actually organize? It isn't just a cost-benefit analysis of why you want to organize an Amazon. It's because the class needs it. You have to organize low-paid workers so they don't resent you and are willing to scab on you. So we have to think about class. It's a pragmatic and ideological thing. It represents a new kind of morality. And we have to think about actually understanding the economy.
With unions, is it just a matter of underdeveloped consciousness, or is there some structural thing that makes them so blinkered?
Well, let me say two things. One is, we shouldn't romanticize the working class. Workers are not spontaneously revolutionary, nor are they spontaneously racist or conservative. The working class has to be made. It has the potential to play this role because of its role in production, because they create new kinds of communities in their workplace, which are hard to create in communities that are so isolated from, where people are so isolated from each other. So there's something about work that both gives you power and gives you a sense of community and gives you a place to resist so you form your own structures that is powerful. But the problem with it is, on the one hand, what you learn as a worker in capitalism is that you're dependent. What you learn is that to survive, you got to think about the long term and can't busy yourself. I'm sorry, the short term, and can't busy yourself with the long term. You got to survive in the short term. You end up exhausted in terms of reading and thinking and going to meetings. You're fragmented because your situation is so different from other workers, or you're competing with them. So workers aren't spontaneously radical. This is something that has to be made and built. And workers may resist, but that comes and goes. That's why you need some larger organizations. Now, the problem with unions as an organization is that they are a vehicle for fighting, but they're a fragmented vehicle. They're particular organizations. They're supposed to represent their members. And even if they're very democratic, which is a lot of what the left criticizes them for, not being democratic, but you can have democratic unions who say, why do you care about Palestine? What do you care if some workers are getting the minimum wage? We're doing better than that. So being democratic isn't enough, because that can also make you insular. That can lead you to duplicating neoliberalism by thinking individually or in terms of only your union. You have to transform unions. And once you start thinking about different kinds of unions, unions that are mobilizing in the community around leading the fight for social services, leading the fight around the environment, mobilizing their members to be organizers and teaching them that, it means changing everything about your organization, what you put your money into, what kind of education you do, what your staff does. It's a question of transforming unions. Now, unions can't be socialist organizations. They're still just unions. But there is space for raising class questions and raising questions about how we understand capitalism, which creates openings for maybe doing some education around socialism. But we still need a socialist organization. We need something that has its feet in unions and its feet outside unions, whose main preoccupation is how do we transform society, not just how do we improve the conditions of a particular work. And that kind of a space where you strategize, which is so focused on developing the capacities and understanding and vision and strategic ability and organizing ability of workers and unions, we don't have. And so I've said this to you before when we were talking about the crisis in labor, that part of the crisis in labor is simultaneously a crisis on the left, which isn't embedded in the labor movement. And that's a difficult question, because embedded in this isn't just going to a picket line. It's actually about living in their communities, being part of their culture. And you really see that in England, in the north of England, where places that were so labor, you know, the only debates used to be about whether people were going to be communists or labor supporters, have gone to the right. We have to appreciate the extent of the defeat we've had. It isn't just that people have lost some wages or pensions. It's that there's been a lowering of expectations and an exposure of how weak our institutions are. And it's going to take a lot to rebuild this. And one of the things that has to happen in the States is that the Sanders moment was very important, even though people like myself and Leo, had anybody asked us, would have said, what are you doing running in the Democratic Party? The reality is that Sanders created space. He affected the discourse. When I say space, I mean space for the left. And he expanded the discourse, brought a lot of young people into politics. And we have to make sure we don't lose this. I mean, there was an infrastructure of communications and education and organizing and mobilizing. We can't lose this. And that's why I think campaigns are so important. The other thing we have to worry about, I think there's a real danger of social democratization. People are going to go into the Democratic Party. Even socialists are going to do that. Given that they don't see another option, we have to assume that a lot of good socialists will go into the Democratic Party. And we can argue with them about the limits of it, but I think we have to figure out how to keep engaging them rather than just write them off. And engaging them means having campaigns, some national campaigns, so people don't just retreat to doing things locally. But the point of national campaigns is it'll constantly expose the Democratic Party. And I think we need that, even if you're working within it. Because otherwise, people will get trapped into small battles. And, you know, every small thing that's won will be seen as wonderful. And we lose what we're actually fighting for as socialists. And the other thing is that's the only way to engage in those larger battles, to build something outside the Democratic Party for when socialists either leave or more likely get kicked out of the Democratic Party and have some kind of a working class base to go to after that, including just other socialists to go to.
That was Sam Gindin. His review of Howard Botwinick's book, Persistent Inequalities, under the provocative title, Why Workers Don't Revolt, was recently posted to the Jacobin website. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. That was some of Natural's Not In It, performed by Everything Everything from the new Gang of Four tribute album, The Problem of Leisure, or Leisure, if you wanted to rhyme with pleasure. People are fighting Amazon not just in New York and Alabama, but also in South Africa, where the company is trying to build on an environmentally and historically sensitive site in Cape Town. The company has found friends in the city government, which has been overriding its own heritage and environmental experts to hasten the development on this particularly inappropriate site, even though there's plenty of other property to develop in the area. Here with more is Leslie London, chair of the Observatory Civic Association in Cape Town. Leslie London. What's the scope of Amazon's operations in South Africa? How big a presence is there now?
They have a head office in Johannesburg, and the Amazon Web Services is based in Cape Town, I think. They're pretty big. They've already sort of insinuated themselves into local government services. They've actually done a lot of back-end work for the city of Cape Town, the municipality. So the fact that the city has now approved this development has something to do with the way in which Amazon is doing business with the city.
Okay, and then that proposal, what is Amazon hoping to do, and why has it attracted so much opposition?
So they want to establish an African headquarters, and they had apparently made a decision already to locate it in Cape Town. So they were supposedly scoping different sites. This particular site is very controversial because it lies in a floodplain on a river which has heritage importance, because it's the site of the first indigenous people's resistance to the colonists. It's also the site where, well, they actually beat the Portuguese in 1510, but the following century the Dutch basically dispossessed the Khoi of their land. in this area. So it's very important historically and from Khoi heritage and spirituality point of view. The land was zoned for open space, meaning that it was essentially zoned for sort of use for recreation or minimal heavy duty activities. It was public land that belonged, this particular piece is in a park, and this small piece was actually owned by the South African Railways. The rest of the land in the park is public land. And the railways actually had a long-term tenant, and they had a long-term lease, and they bought the land. They bought the land very cheaply, but the land didn't have development rights. In other words, it was really meant for conservation use and some limited recreational uses, such as a small golf course, and there was a conference center and a chiropractor and a few other activities, but very low intensity. And the land was open space, and that's really important because the connection between the river and the mountain is key to Khoi heritage. What the developers then did, they bought the land very cheap. They immediately got the loan from an investment company, and within months, they were already starting to develop this proposal to get the land rezoned and to get an environmental authorization. And it's taken them 5 years to get there. But despite massive public opposition from environmentalists, from community members, from Khoi groups, and from just ordinary people who just can't believe that it's been approved, the authorities have approved it, incredibly over the opposition of the city's own environmental management department, who think this is a bad idea. It's bad for climate change. It's bad for stormwater management. It's bad for biodiversity. And the heritage authorities for the province, who said basically the approval was unlawful. That's the word they used, unlawful, because they had turned down the application because it was so destructive of intangible heritage. So for us, Amazon have been behind this for a long time, but they haven't come out clearly. So in the public participation process,
they created some sort of corporate entity to handle the development, right? That so there's a distance from Amazon itself.
It's a trust, which is developing 14.7 hectares of land. Amazon are this, they're not going to own it. They're going to be the anchor tenant for one of the precincts. So in fact, the property is 15,000 square meters of concrete. It's 18 buildings of between 20 and 40 meters high. And Amazon will occupy about 60,000 square meters. So about 40% of the entire plot is, well, concrete is Amazon, because Amazon is very high and very dense. As you know, the buildings are big behemoth buildings. But basically, without Amazon, this development won't go ahead because it's a very expensive development, because you have to build in a floodplain, and to build in a floodplain, they're going to have to chuck in thousands of tons of infill to lift the land, which will aggravate flooding. It's already a floodplain, and it's going to aggravate it. So Amazon are very much in the background. But when the approvals were announced, it was a big, with hubris, with glee, that Amazon was now, this is fantastic, because Amazon was coming to Cape Town, going to create lots of jobs, all the usual stuff. But in the lead up, in fact, what happened was the developers' consultants, the environmental management consultants, withdrew documents from their website slightly early. So they had put up all the documents for public participation, for the public to comment. And there was a deadline for us to give the consultants comments, but the consultants were due to give their comments to the Department of Environmental Affairs, in another 6 weeks. So there was still time for us to use the documents and send our comments directly to the department, but they withdrew the documents. And so we complained. When they put the documents back, they didn't put back the documents that specified what Amazon was going to be on the plot. And when we asked them, they said to us, this is proprietary information. It's confidential information for the rezoning application, which was complete nonsense, because the rezoning application went in without any such information. So clearly there was something going on that Amazon didn't want to be seen to be there. I know that a number of the journalists I've spoken to are puzzled, because the Liesbeek Leisure Property Trust they kind of act coy about Amazon. So, Amazon has said nothing about this. They've been completely silent.
Yeah, I read a Reuters story where they refused comment to Reuters, so I guess they just don't want to talk about this at all. But it's given the ecological and historical importance of this site,
they didn't really have to develop here. I'm sure there's plenty of alternative sites they could have developed. It's almost as if it's a pure hostile gesture. It's really hard
that
to
That is how it's being interpreted. So, I mean, initially, we weren't sure about Amazon. We heard about it. We weren't sure about it, and we didn't see it as an Amazon issue. We know that Amazon was looking at other sites in Cape Town, and as with many cities, with COVID, a lot of the sort of large commercial centers have been emptied. So there's actually a couple of sites which are looking for tenants, and there's one particular big insurance company which has a big campus. It's not in such a desirable area, but I know that the realtors, the estate agents, have been trying to persuade Amazon to go there. And as what I'm told is that this was their number one choice, and then there are other, there's 2, 3, 4, and 5 choices elsewhere. So they can go elsewhere if they want, but they haven't said anything. They're keeping their lips zipped and they haven't spoken to us, etc. We actually tried contacting Amazon Seattle office, so we wrote to Jeff Bezos, didn't get a reply. So we wrote him again and we couriered it to Seattle. We know it arrived in Seattle, didn't get a reply. We then wrote to Mackenzie Scott. No reply, and we just sent an email to Andy Jassy, no reply.
Well, I guess Bezos is preparing for his space journey. Given this level of popular opposition, what's the prospect for stopping this project, or is it just a done deal by now?
Not the only way. There will be sort of the court of public opinion, but there's also the legal route. So we are pursuing that. So basically, we think we have quite a strong legal case. The fact that the city's own environmental specialists think this is absolutely disastrous. The city planners overruled its own specialists. The city environmental specialist said no. But also, they are supposed to have concurrent decision-making with the Heritage Authority for the province, which is called Heritage Western Cape. And since they declared it unlawful, essentially they approved that over the head of another government department. So we think we would have good grounds in court to challenge this and stop it. There is also a smaller matter to do with the water license, which we are going to appeal. So basically, there's the legal routes, the administrative legal routes under the South African Constitution. There have been precedents. So there's an area in Cape Town called the Philippi Horticultural Area. It's a farming area on the outskirts of Cape Town, which is a very productive farming area of small farmers producing vegetables in the main, who have been threatened by a sort of high-end housing development being put up on the land, which would interfere with the aquifer, the recharge of the underground water. And the courts actually ruled in their favor and said that the approval for that development was flawed because it did not do a climate change assessment. And as you know, Cape Town nearly ran out of water a few years ago. So it's bizarre to do that without a climate change assessment. And in fact, this development also has not had a climate change assessment. It's basically had some specialist studies around hydrology and the geology, but no climate change assessment, and yet the city's own climate change people are saying, no, don't do this. We need this green strip coast to coast. So we think we've got some leverage there, and we have a lot of public support. The sad thing about this is that the heritage issues have been exploited by the process. The developers actually had no support from indigenous groups when they started. They actually came to present to us in Observatory. They presented their heritage plan, and in the meeting, the consultant was asked, well, who have you consulted with amongst the Khoi groups, First Nation groups? And the consultant could not name one group. He sort of blustered that they had consulted, but he couldn't name actually who he had consulted with. So there was obviously no consultation. More or less a year later, Heritage Western Cape issued a provisional protection order over the land, because they were concerned about the threat to heritage. They have been wanting to grade the land as a provincial heritage resource for a long time because of its importance. So they issued a provisional protection order. The developer obviously appealed the order, but bizarrely, other government departments joined the developers. So Public Works, the City of Cape Town, the municipality, and in fact the Department of Environmental Affairs, which makes the decision on the environmental authorization, joined the appeal on the side of the developers. And in the course of that appeal, it was quite clear that the developers had no Khoi support, because the first meeting of that tribunal, the room was full of Khoi chiefs who were all 100% opposed to the development, adamant, you know, and one Khoi chief actually, I remember he slammed his fist down on the table and he says, this will be the first case of expropriation without compensation if it's approved. You know, so he was really angry about this. The developers kind of responded by saying, okay, They didn't put it in these words, but essentially what they were saying is, we made a mistake, we haven't consulted, we're going to consult now. But what they did was they found Khoi groups who were willing to support them. And so what's happened now is this terrible divide and rule kind of strategy, which was actually named in the tribunal outcome. The tribunal directive actually says this is terrible. Instead of like unity and government departments and Khoi people working together to achieve the best outcome for heritage, what's happened is this divide and rule. And so you have Khoi supporters of the development who are being presented as the voice of indigenous people. And then you have a whole lot of Khoi opposition saying, not in my name, our heritage is not for sale. It gets quite dirty, actually. So we've been smeared. Tariq, who's one of the outspoken Khoi leaders opposed the development, he had to get a protection order against another Khoi leader who threatened him. So it's the sort of script all over the world. A lot of money at stake. You're going to get this kind of really nasty stuff. And it's going to be ongoing. So.
And finally, this program does not have a vast listenership, but those who are listening, is there anything we can do to support the resistance?
If attention can be focused on Amazon, because, look, this decision is not a decision to Amazon or no Amazon. It's a decision about a development in an inappropriate place, in an inappropriate way, with which Amazon is going to be irrevocably connected, associated forevermore if it goes ahead. So putting pressure on Amazon, I think, would be helpful, because international pressure does matter. And we've seen that, you know, in our campaign, we've seen that international groups pick up on Amazon. But it's actually the struggle of ordinary people that matters. And so I think solidarity with the campaign. I wish I could speak social media language, but I'm a Luddite, so I can't even tell you what the Facebook page is or the hashtag. All I know, I was told today, I must put a hashtag before Make the Lizbig Matter, because that is our kind of slogan. If there's a way for listeners to pick up on hashtag Make the Lizbig Matter, and it's Lizbig, LIESBEEK, then they should be able to get lots of information.
That was Leslie London, chair of the Observatory Civic Association in Cape Town, South Africa. The hashtag he was grappling with is Lizbig. LIESBEEK. You can find their Facebook page by searching for Make the Lizbeek Matter. The Observatory Civic Association is on the web at obs.org.za. obs.org.za. And now the grim subject of solitary confinement. Tana Ganeva is a criminal justice reporter and author of a piece on the Rolling Stone website on the topic. Tana Ganeva. All right, first, background on solitary confinement. How widely used is this in the U.S.? How many prisoners in solitary?
There are 80,000 men, women, and children in some form of isolation across the U.S. in both state and federal facilities.
Children?
I mean, like, obviously not like four-year-olds, but you know what I mean, like teenagers and people under 18, yes.
We're kind of alone in the world in this practice, aren't we?
I can't definitively say if nobody else does it. Like, I imagine, like, it happens in Syria or whatever. But, yeah, like, among alleged democracies, yeah.
Why do people get thrown into solitary? What behavioral defect is this supposed to cure?
A lot of people have this perception that the people in solitary are either there for their own protection or because if they were in the general population, they would be eating people's faces off or something, right? But something that surprised me is that, like, you can get thrown into solitary for literally anything that pisses off a guard, basically, is what it is. And, I mean, I'm sure there are some circumstances where, you know, maybe somebody does need to be isolated because they're a danger to others or whatever. But, all the examples that I encountered are, like, you know, one guy got thrown in there because he, like, spilled his water on a guard. Something that's been happening during the pandemic, which is, you know, truly awesome, is that there have been cases where, like, when prisoners have tried to talk about conditions and, like the huge mismanagement of the prison populations during the pandemic, you can get thrown in the hole for that. After the first couple of times that happened, I never wrote a single article that used the prisoner's real name because, like, a bunch of people got thrown in the hole just for talking to reporters.
And how long do people typically spend in these hellholes?
So there aren't definitive averages, just because it's like, I mean, for one thing, it's called different things everywhere, including in the same institution. There are definitely instances, I mean, that I covered of, like, you know, one guy's been in Michigan solitary for 47 years. And I think as I point out in my story, Juan Mendez, who's the UN Special Rapporteur for Torture, said that more than 15 days in solitary constitutes torture. And yeah, there's this guy in Michigan who's been in solitary for 47 years. There's a couple of other people that have been there for a few decades also. There's people serving, like 10 to 12 years.
Yeah, there's somebody in their piece who says he was told he's never getting out.
Yeah, according to him, yes. I mean, obviously the guards weren't going to talk to me, but
yeah. And what does this do to people? What are the psychological consequences and physical consequences too, I'm sure?
You know, solitary is one of those things where, like, everyone knows it's bad, but, like, when you really dig into it, it's insane. It's like, I mean, people can try to commit suicide regularly. You know, they scream or they stop talking. Like, one guy went blind, basically, I think temporarily, but still just from, like, having nothing to look at for so long. Like, very, very intense PTSD symptoms, like anxiety, depression, and, you know, some guys go insane and, like, literally smear their shit on the wall.
Weirdly, this has origins with the Quakers, right?
Yeah, so in 1839, the Quakers in, I believe it was Pennsylvania, introduced solitary because they, you know, with good intentions. Like, they thought that it would help prisoners reflect and, like, you know, have some sort of, like, rebirth or something. But instead, many of the prisoners went crazy, and a lot of them committed suicide. So the Quakers, I guess to their credit, like, abandoned the practice. But by that time, it had become, like, fairly well ingrained in the U.S. Criminal justice system, particularly in the Northeast.
What are the longer-term consequences? Do people recover, or are they scarred for life with this?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you're... viewers are familiar with the case of Khalif Browder, who was a teenager that was put in solitary at Rikers and also, like, you know, had the shit beaten out of him by both guards and other inmates. And, you know, he got, you know, his case became, like, really well known. Jay-Z took up the cause and, you know, he killed himself. Like, when he was living at home, like, I guess he would just, like, pace, do nothing all day. But, well, no, he tried to go to college, et cetera, but what he would do at home was just, like, pace around his small room all day because that was the only, like, it reminded him of being in solitary and being in the cell, which is, like, you know, is an extremely, extremely severe PTSD symptom. Then he killed himself. And then, yeah, for a lot of people, just, like, lifelong depression, anxiety, PTSD, just horrible stuff. Yeah, and then, like, yeah, even some physical or death, like, in solitary as, like, one case, I profiled a man named John Lancaster that was, like, so severely neglected, he just, like, dropped dead. Didn't just drop dead. He was, as his sister put it, he was tortured to death.
And what about political organization around this? Are there any hopes for banning this practice? I guess New York State did recently, right? But what else? What about elsewhere?
New York State did it, but I have my concerns because, like, one of the things that Michigan, for example, does is they call solitary by different names, so it doesn't officially count as solitary. So I, you know, given my skepticism of New York State, current New York State lawmakers doing anything actually progressive, Andrew Cuomo, I would worry that they're just going to, like, rename it something else. But, I mean, you know, fingers crossed, like, hopefully they will go through with it.
And your article mentions a new website that's trying to gather together the testimony of people in solitary. Could you talk about that a bit?
Yes. It's called Silenced Voices from Solitary. And I just got to say, like, you know, I want to be like, ooh, I'm such a reporter or whatever. But, like, you know, the woman who organized it and, like, made it happen, Jack Williams, has done such phenomenal work over the years, like, both building relationships with all these inmates who... you know, it's not exactly easy for them to have contacts with the outside world. You know, she's got, like, brilliant statistics on Michigan numbers and stuff like that. So she's the one that initially had, like, the raw materials for the website, and then she helped construct the website. And then also Scott Hechinger, who's a former public defender and now works at a criminal justice nonprofit, helped shepherd it, like, into the world. And, again, Silenced Voices from Solitary, and it's brilliant because it not only has all this raw data and raw testimonies, but it's organized in this really brilliant way where you can, like, cross-check different horror stories with like letters from prisoners. You can like click on PTSD or suicide attempt, and it'll like pull up all the letters of prisoners describing those experiences.
Incarceration rates in the country, after rising for decades, have kind of rolled over, declining slightly. Not anywhere near as rapidly as they should be, but they are declining slightly. Is there any sign of that happening in solitary, or is that looking pretty steady?
It's a good sign that New York State did that. Hopefully, it's not just like a bull law. The thing about solitary, though, unlike something like a more obvious metric, like declining incarceration rates, is that it's a completely opaque system. Like, nobody has to report anything. They further undermine any sort of transparency by defining it differently, even in the same institution. So I don't see it. Also, you know, solitary is one of those things where criminal justice nut jobs like me and you, I'm sure, like know how bad it is, or almost how bad it is. But if you're like, you know, kind of like a general political person, whatever, like, I imagine you A, assume it's people who have to be in there because they pose a serious danger to others. Or, like, hey, that doesn't sound so bad. I get my own room. Like, and people just don't realize how horrible it is. Whereas, like, you know, the death penalty, for example, is, like, a pretty visceral, there are many more witnesses to the death penalty, for example. Or even, like, you know, reporters covering life without parole and stuff like that. But, like, solitary is just one of those things. I mean, and there are no court records, right? Because there's no judicial proceeding that would be marked with documentation that could be accessed by reporters, which is why this website is so important.
So this is just under the guard's whim, basically. There's no formal procedures. The guards just say, go into the hole?
They claim there's a procedure, but that's not what I saw in my reporting.
They just do it on a whim, basically?
Not officially, but as far as I could tell, in practice, yes.
That was a criminal justice reporter, Tana Ganeva. Her article about solitary is on the Rolling Stone website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the Liberation of the Prisoners scene from Beethoven's Fidelio, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in chorus under Georg Schulte. Till next week, bye.